anesthesia enthusiasts and possibly people who are pretending to be anesthesia enthusiasts. My name is John Crow, and you're listening to Style Points. Today on the podcast, I have special guest Dr. Ben Fidelis, who will be chatting with us about imposter syndrome. Before that, I'll hand it over to my co-host, Nate Moore, to talk about this month's RSI.
Thanks, John. I'm really excited to introduce Dr. Veronica Takugang today. She is an anesthesia intern here at UC, but she's not new to Cincinnati. She grew up in the city, and her first job was at Grater's. So we'll be seeing if she still has any free ice cream connections after the show. Veronica will be teaching us about inhaled anesthetics. Welcome, Veronica.
Thanks, Nate. So the course of general anesthesia can be divided into three phases: induction, maintenance, and emergence. The majority of general anesthetics administered today use inhaled agents during the maintenance phase. And while most adult cases use IV agents for induction, pediatric patients commonly receive inhalation inductions to avoid awake IV placement. For these reasons, it is important to understand how inhaled anesthetics work. Let's first think about how these agents get into the body. Inhaled agents start as a liquid, but are turned into a gas by a vaporizer, then are swept into the lungs along with the fresh gas flow from the ventilator. Note that the patient does not necessarily receive the concentration set on the vaporizer of inhaled anesthetic. The actual composition of the gas mixture depends on three factors: fresh gas flow rate, the volume of the breathing system, and any absorption by the machine or breathing circuit. So the greater the fresh gas flow rate, the smaller the breathing system volume, and the lower circuit absorption, the closer the inspired gas concentration will be compared to the fresh gas concentration. Things that affect the uptake of inhaled anesthetics include solubility in the blood, alveolar blood flow, and the difference in partial pressure between alveolar gas and venous blood. So how do we know that our patients are getting enough inhaled anesthetic to keep them deep enough through surgery? One factor we use to ensure our patients are adequately anesthetized is the MAC, or mean alveolar concentration. MAC values are standardized such that getting one MAC of a given agent prevents movement in about 50% of patients. The amount of each agent needed to achieve one MAC is different, and these values decrease with age. For example, a healthy 40-year-old needs to receive 2.1% of sevoflurane to achieve one of MAC. However, the MAC decreases about 6% with each decade of age, so the same patient at 50 will only need 1.97% of sevoflurane to achieve one MAC. Modern OR monitors will automatically calculate the patient's current MAC percentage based on the amount of anesthetic agent the patient exhales, but not all will automatically adjust the MAC based on the patient's age. So be mindful of what one MAC really means for the patient in front of you. Inhalation anesthetics include nitrous oxide, halothane, isoflurane, desflurane, xenon, and the most commonly used in the developed world, sevoflurane. Each agent has its own unique properties that cause variable effects on each organ system, so it is important to take that into consideration when formulating an anesthetic plan for a patient. Nitrous oxide is an NMDA receptor antagonist that is relatively inexpensive. It rapidly diffuses from the blood into air-filled cavities, which can be dangerous in instances such as air embolisms or pneumothorax. Nitrous oxide can even diffuse into the tracheal tube cuff itself, increasing the pressure against the tracheal mucosa. However, it has very fast onset and offset, which can help with quick wake-ups. Halothane used to be a common anesthetic, but has fallen out of favor. It has been associated with liver damage and can cause direct myocardial depression, leading to low blood pressure, which can be exacerbated in patients taking beta blockers or calcium channel blockers. Halothane can cause hepatic dysfunction and, in extremely rare cases, cause halothane hepatitis. Isoflurane is a pungent agent that is relatively soluble in the blood, resulting in slightly slower onset and offset compared to sevoflurane. At higher concentrations, it can dilate coronary arteries, leading to a theoretical coronary steal of blood away from maximally dilated ischemic lesions. However, this has not been observed to result in clinically significant effects. Sevoflurane is relatively insoluble in blood, making it an excellent choice for a smooth and relatively rapid induction and emergence in both kids and adults. It is the most commonly used inhaled agent in the developed world and has a good safety profile and is inexpensive. Desflurane has very low solubility in the blood, causing very rapid induction and emergence from anesthesia. However, it is also an extremely potent greenhouse gas. For this reason, many centers have moved away from desflurane use. It's also extremely pungent and can cause airway irritation, making it a poorer choice for inhalation inductions. Xenon is an odorless noble gas that has very fast onset and emergence parameters. Like nitrous oxide, it is an NMDA inhibitor. It has very little effect on cardiovascular, hepatic, or renal systems and may actually be protective against neuronal ischemia. Unfortunately, cost and limited availability have prevented its widespread use, so the use of xenon is mostly limited to test questions currently. I hope this brief overview of inhaled anesthetics helps you breathe easier next time you are faced with a problem on a test or in the OR.
It's not like I'm talking national secrets. This is my opinion about a topic that you approached me about. So,
yeah, that's true. And interestingly, I get to see where the downloads come from for my podcast.
It shows the metrics.
And one of the places that has, I would say, an abnormally high amount of downloads is Washington, D.C. I don't know why.
All right.
And maybe it's the FBI.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, exactly. Or maybe there's just... Maybe it's just the podcast culture and traffic sucks and DMV.
That's probably it.
It's just, hey, we are progressive young listeners who, you know, this is how we consume our information because we're stuck on the metro or the traffic for 90 minutes.
Yeah, that's great.
For the 5 mile commute.
I imagine I could probably sort all of my listeners by where the traffic is the worst.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. I feel honored to be, you know, offered this opportunity.
I knew that you wanted to give your little spiel right up front since you were a very important person.
Oh, I don't know about important, but I am a person. And similarly, all of the views expressed are my own. Nothing here that I state reflects any endorsement from the Department of Defense, Department of State, United States Air Force, United States Air Force School of Aerospace Medicine, or any of the alike. This is my opinion as a student, as a scholar, as a, you know, I call myself a professional. But
someday I would hope to have a similar disclaimer. I'm one of those people that gets up in front of people and says, "Well, I have no disclosures, but if anybody is willing to pay me, then that would be great."
Yeah, here's my bank account.
Although I guess I could add advertisements to the podcast, but I haven't done that yet. So I don't have any sponsors.
That's okay.
If you want to be a sponsor on the podcast, please contact me at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com and we would be happy to be paid by you.
That's a great plug.
So I want to start with one of my get to know you questions.
Great.
Which is my dinner question that I ask during my residency interviews. I asked it to a lot of people yesterday when they were coming in to interview for our program. If you could have dinner with anyone in the world, could be somebody from the past or even from fiction, who would you have dinner with and why?
So my initial reaction would be, if I could have a dinner party, it would be both sets of my grandparents. Some of them passed when I was young, and some of them unfortunately had you know, just decline in the mental capacity as I got older. And I think I would just have such a lovely dinner getting to know them now that I have kids, now that I have had some military experience, that I have had time in this world and been able to learn a little bit more about them. You know, as growing up as a kid, I love my grandparents, but you appreciate people differently as you pay, you know, you pass through different phases of life. So I think that would be my dinner party from my personal level. And if I'm going to get a bonus separate, maybe a lunch, I would probably say Dolly Parton.
Oh.
Saint Dolly Parton, just a wonderful, kind soul who's, you know.
That's perhaps the safest answer I've ever heard.
Okay. All right. All right.
That's good.
But I mean, she's just a you know, an amazing individual, a philanthropist who has, you know, broken ground and barriers over time and has been, you know, with us. So Dolly Parton.
Man, I think that I would leave lunch with Dolly Parton feeling like inspired and hopeful. That's
right. Like, she's just wonderful and in so many ways. So I don't know anyone. Actually, I probably don't know anyone who couldn't get behind that answer. And if you do, then you know we can throw it down later.
Yeah, right. Exactly. The reason why we're here today is to talk about something that is near and dear to you, which is talking about imposter syndrome. What about imposter syndrome drew you in? Why are you interested to talk about it?
Absolutely. Great question. Imposter syndrome is especially prevalent in medical training. We're in a high-stakes environment where we all want to do well. Like we have a passion, a calling, I hope, to take care of our patients, and our decisions, our management, our job day-to-day has very dire consequences and impact, and also on conversely on the positive side. Through that, we often have quite a bit of pressure on our shoulders. That's, you know, some of it is self-imposed, and certainly some of it is external. Talking about imposter syndrome is important because of the prevalence in this environment and the impact it has on us. I believe that, you know, at some point in almost everyone's medical career, they'll have some symptoms, some signs of imposter syndrome, whether it's full-blown feelings of fraud or just inadequacy. You know, it's certainly, you know, if it hasn't hit you yet, it probably will at some point.
Whenever I saw that you were giving a talk about imposter syndrome at the Ohio Society of Anesthesiologists meeting, which is where I first saw that this was something that you were interested in, I have to admit, I thought that you were probably the least likely person that I know that I would imagine would have imposter syndrome, which is why I was excited to talk to you about it, partially. I remember when you first came to the department a few years ago, and the way that you were described to me was sort of as the opposite of somebody who might be struggling with imposter syndrome, just as a superb clinician and somebody who always has a good head on his shoulders, very professional, solid guy. So tell me, what is it about that description that you don't feel applies to you or that you struggle with?
Great. First of all, thank you. I feel honored that people perceive and describe me that way. I think it's really through some self-discovery and my own vulnerability that I've discovered. Sometimes I feel like I don't know the answer. And the truth is, a lot of people don't have all the answers all the time. It's not until we have this self-reflection and this acceptance of who we are, and we're all human, we're all striving to be the best versions of ourselves. If we fail to recognize and we fail to normalize and label it, I think we do all ourselves, we do each other a disfavor. We're all professionals and we all suffer from these things. And it is, I think, you know, one of my jobs is to normalize this and say, hey, this is your perception of me, and I do feel like I've had wonderful training. I show up every day ready to work. I do all the things that, you know, we should do, but at the same time, I still am far from where I want to be, and we're all striving for it. But if I'm doing it, certainly everyone else is too.
So let's back up a little bit. I'd love to hear more about your background, your intro to medicine, your pathway to being part of the C-Stars. Tell me more about all that.
Absolutely. So I took a non-straightforward approach to medicine. I always knew I wanted to go in the medical field. But when I graduated from undergrad, I knew I wasn't quite ready yet. I knew the decision to commit to medicine it's a big one, right? You put that as your priority. You know, I feel that our profession is not one to be taken lightly, and it's not just, oh, it's the next path because I don't know what else to do. That shouldn't be the answer in my book. I took a few years off, didn't know quite what I wanted to do in the interim. I did a little bit of business consulting. I spent some time actually working in the agricultural industry. One of my great grandfathers was a farrier in the cavalry. And I was like, oh man, that's a pretty cool piece of family history. So I went to the West, went to farrier school, learned how to shoe horses, moved back to Florida, did that for a little while, realized it was backbreaking work. And then I managed a show horse barn, did some importing and sales and management of in that arena, you would say. And then I was like, okay, I'm ready. I'm ready to go back. I'm ready to hit the books, ready to hit the lab. You know, let's continue this on. So that was about a 4-year hiatus. Did some postdoc work where I was down in Florida at the University of Florida, and applied for medical school. I did not get in the first time, which is not an uncommon thing.
Neither did I.
And here we are. And got in on the second round. Did my training at University of South Florida in Tampa, Florida. Went on to do residency at, joined the military during medical school, because this was also something near and dear to my heart. Come from, both grandfathers were in the Army, Air Corps. And I also wanted to continue on that tradition. I think at that point, we were solidly almost into a decade of our overseas involvement. And we can, again, another discussion, whether right or wrong, but that was the state of affairs. And I felt a calling to help those who were doing work to try to make the world a better place, or at least, you know, that was all of our, where our heart was. Went through the HPSB program, managed to get civilian training all the way through. So did residency at University of Maryland Medical Center, shock trauma in Baltimore, and then did a critical care fellowship at Vanderbilt University, and had an outstanding group of mentors at both places, especially Vanderbilt. Graduated in the midst of COVID, towards the end of COVID, from fellowship. Came here as my first duty station. Again, very, very lucky to come to an institution with a heritage and a high volume of sick patients, to work in the OR, to work in the ICUs, to continue to do ECMO management, retrieval, transport, and then also do my Air Force job, which is to work at our C-STAR Cincinnati, or Center for Sustainment Training and Readiness, where our job here is to prepare and validate members of our CCAT, Critical Care Air Transport Team. It's the final portion of their pipeline. It's a 2-week course, which is both instructional, but is really assessment validation in order to take care of critically ill patients downrange and transport them, basically a flying ICU. Sometimes it's back of pickup trucks, sometimes it's rotor wing, sometimes it's fixed wing, and just preparing for what's next.
That all sounds really amazing. And I fortunately had the opportunity to go see some of the C-STAR simulation stuff with Jesse when I had him on the podcast too. And I had no idea how much really cool stuff you guys have.
Oh, it's amazing. It's, I'm really feel lucky to be part of it. And that's what my job also is when I deploy as well.
So what deployments have you been on?
Yeah, so managed to have a deployment that was supposed to be 6 months and turned into a 7.5-month deployment in East Africa. It's part of a special operations team out there. And without getting into details, we had a really large area of the continent to cover and provide medical support. We were the asset to mitigate risk and to take care of, you know, our brothers and sisters and our partner nations that were doing the work, mostly anti-terrorism work.
Okay. So through all that, you clearly have an incredible CV. Everyone around you respects you very much. When did you first start to recognize imposter syndrome in yourself?
Absolutely. And the way I think of imposter syndrome too is a spectrum, right? There's people that certainly have full-blown imposter syndrome where they feel despite objective evidence of their knowledge and performance that they are a fraud. And that's really, really tough to be in that position, because in my mind, or thinking about it, a fraud is someone who doesn't have the skills that they actually have in their armamentarium. I feel that most of us manifest imposter syndrome in inadequacy or preparation or feelings of underpreparation, despite adequate preparation or data that we've done the job, done the work, and we're capable. And that's really where it was for me. It's like, hey, you know, I am the line. I am responsible for these patients, for this job, and am I good enough? Is this, you know, so many people are looking at me. Do I have what it takes?
Was this something that you started to feel in medical school or residency, or more as an attending? What do you think?
Sure. I believe it was towards the end of residency to being a junior attending. And I think for me, it was more the reality of the application. And, you know, we're lucky enough not to work in silos. We have a great group of colleagues here that always back each other. You ask for help and you end up having to kick people away because you have so much help. But for me, it was towards that period where I'm the one making decisions. And again, this is the impact of these decisions, the nature of our job. We see those decisions and the downstream effects of those pretty quickly compared to other areas of medicine where you're seeing someone every 4 months for titration of outpatient blood pressure medication, right? Where we have a dangerous job, we make critical decisions, and we do it in a very, very short amount of time with sometimes limited data points. And that's high stakes. That's a lot riding on that. I feel some of my self-reflection is healthy concern and respect for that responsibility. And I think part of it too is making sure that, you know, some other people, you can show up and have a bad day and it doesn't have much consequence. But if one of us shows up and has a bad day, well, it's a bad day, not only for you, but some other folks too.
This is really true. You know, when you think about other areas of medicine, when an internal medicine doctor sees a patient and decides to prescribe a medication, the pathway for the medication getting to the patient is very different. For that internal medicine doctor, he will go back to his computer, he will type in an order, or he will, you know, tell one of his residents to type in an order, one of his APPs. That order goes in and it goes to the pharmacy, who double checks it, makes sure that it's correct. And then after the pharmacy, it will typically be dispensed by a nurse. And if it's a high alert medication, then that gets double checked again by the nurse and it's given to the patient. For us, it's very different. We see something on the monitor that we don't like and we have to push a medicine. We open the Omnicell, pull out the medicine, draw it up, and give it immediately into the patient's IV. There's not usually any double checking. You're right. I think that that sort of dramatic responsibility is a weighty thing that we have to deal with.
I agree. You hit the nail on the head, and we can talk all about the safety systems and everything, but I think the emphasis today is really on how do we handle those pressures, those stressors, and still have the confidence in our skills, in our knowledge, in our training, in our previous repetitions, in order to provide the best care and not let that stand in the way of thinking as clearly as we can in those situations.
Did you have any sort of event that made you say to yourself, you know, imposter syndrome is something that I want to talk about to my colleagues. I want to share my experience, because that's a vulnerable thing that you're doing, to put yourself out there and say, look, this is who I am. I mean, spoiler alert, I think everybody has some degree of this. I certainly do myself. I feel that way all the time. But what event or mindset change pushed you over to the idea of, you know, I'm going to put together a talk about this?
Absolutely. I think two things. One, in my personal life, I've realized that I struggle to be vulnerable, whether that's, you know, with my wife, with my friends, my family. And I realized, like, this also extends to my professional life. So in this personal sort of quest to be more me, or at least get in touch with myself and connect with those around me, people I love, my colleagues, my patients, this is a critical portion of that is having the self-awareness that, hey, I have these feelings too. And you know what? You probably do too. But let me go first. Let me share with you my story. Let me share with you my feelings. And maybe then, you know, you won't feel as alone either.
When residents ask me questions that I don't know the answer to, which is more often than I'd like to admit, I think. In the beginning, when I was a junior attending, I very much felt like, oh, I have to know the answer to this. And I would feel very terrible if I didn't know. And so I would often deflect or say something like, well, why don't you look that up?
Or, why don't you teach me, yeah, right?
Something like that. But I've started trying to say, you know, I don't remember. Let's look it up together. Let's both learn. And I think that that's a little bit freeing. It's helped me be a better teacher and probably be a better person to be more vulnerable like that, even though it's hard.
It is hard. But you also realize that when you can be honest with yourself and honest with others, it feels so much better. Just that weight is lifted off your shoulders, and it's okay not to know the answer. And I think part of my critical care training made that easier because, you know, in the ICU, the patients are so heterogeneous. They don't read the studies. We're like extrapolating information. You have all these people and you're trying to make assessments, integrate information, make the best decision. And then, of course, it's a dynamic environment. So it's the ICU training and fellowship helped me in the OR, not just from a clinical standpoint, but from the fact that it's okay to say you don't know. And that's why you have a team or you have resources in order to, you know, arrive at the right answer. And sometimes it's you know, not knowing it on the tip of your tongue is an okay thing.
Do you think that being in the military helped you with your mindset in terms of imposter syndrome? Did it make it more challenging? What do you think?
That's a good one. I think it's a mixed bag. I think the environment in which I practice medicine certainly amplified those feelings at times when you're the sole three-member medical team in this area, relied on by, you know, layers and layers of folks. You feel that pressure for sure. And I think that drives you to train, to prepare, and to know these things. And through the training, preparation, the reps, you realize that you actually do have it. I think also in the military, there's quite a bit of experience, inexperience. There's quite a bit of variety in levels of intelligence, application of that intelligence, right, and skill set. And seeing that variety, I think, was helpful. In medical school, everyone is a super achiever of some sorts. We've made it to this level. You know, everyone is, you know, board certified in the pursuit of board certification. They're well read. They're well published. And I think that is not necessarily a true representation of life in general, right? We surround ourselves, we spend most of the time working hours at work around these, you know, super smart people. And that sometimes can be challenging, that comparison and those things. It can also be very supportive if you have a resilient culture, but I think it also sets yourself up to, you know, feeling that way a little bit more frequently than maybe in other settings.
So what do you think we need to do to have a culture that's a little bit more resilient, that supports people like both of us who struggle with these feelings?
So, of course, you know, you and I were at the Grand Rounds yesterday with Dr. Amy Hansen out of Boston Children's, who's
fantastic.
Wonderful.
Phenomenal.
Yes, absolutely. Who primarily spoke to us in this joint Grand Rounds about burnout and resilient culture at the divisional and department levels. So plug for her. But imposter syndrome is a part of that. And I look at that. I look at the burnout and the resiliency in culture of an institution or a divisional level as kind of like the strategic overarching framework. The things that I try to share with my residents, my colleagues, are more on the tactical or individual level. Like, how can I own this? And I think the change starts when we, as teachers who are responsible for residents, who interact with nursing anesthetists, who work with fellows, with all sorts of different levels of folks, if we demonstrate this vulnerability and we provide our trainees and those around us with a safe space to share their feelings or to come to us with questions, concerns, challenges, I think that's where we build it from the ground up. So I think there's two ways of doing it: from the top down, super important, but also it is our responsibility to own a piece of it, and that starts with yourself.
One thing that helps me to understand things better is specific examples. I wonder if you'd be willing to tell a story or two about situations where you felt like you did right by our trainees or by somebody else you were with in being vulnerable, talking about a situation where you might have felt like you did it right.
Absolutely. The example that comes to mind was in the ICU, which is a perfect place to not know the answer and still be okay with not knowing the answer. And it was a complex patient who had multi-system organ failure and some complex things going on with the social aspects of his life. And at this point, you know, it's pretty straightforward, challenging, but pretty straightforward what we needed to do from a medical standpoint. But when I said, I don't know if this is the right thing to do for the patient, this bristled the hair of some of my consulting colleagues who were discussing about mechanical support devices and durable options for a patient and multi-system organ failure that started as heart failure. And I think having a discussion in front of everyone, meaning trainees, medical students, multidisciplinary team, and saying, hey, there's more to this. We need to not make decisions for someone else, which we can talk about paternalism another time, but to really say, hey, this, there's a lot of conflicting data and I don't know what to do with it. It's real easy to look at endpoints and target endpoints of certain things, organ function or what have you, but it's different to look at the big picture and say, I'm not sure what's right or wrong. And we need to figure this out together as a team because I don't know the right answer. And just saying, you know, this decision, my feelings in front of surgeons, in front of, you know, several other attending teams, I think showed, you know, my colors to my team that it's okay that, you know, when the person in charge of my team doesn't know the answer and just owns it, and that's okay. I don't need to fake it or make these decisions quickly or without deep thought.
I have been in situations before with some of my senior residents, and they will ask me a question about a plan that we have for a patient. And I'll say something like, well, I don't really know. What do you think we should do? But I've noticed that they don't actually believe me when I say that. Oftentimes, I'll say, yeah, yeah, okay, but what do you actually want to do? It's like, no, what I'm telling you the truth. I don't actually know what the right thing to do is here, and I am seeking your input as somebody who's also done this before, you know?
That's a great way of doing it. And I think we often, you know, as a trainee, you have this great advantage of working with different attendings on a daily basis, see how different things are done. You are in a unique position where you're collecting all this data, collecting different approaches. You have the ability, and then you graduate from training and you're practicing an OR on your own or overseeing 2-3 rooms, sometimes 4 running together. And unless you actively seek out colleagues, actively talk to your surgeons about his or her approach and have these discussions, the further you get out, the more and more alone you might end up feeling, and then the harder it is to reach out. So having, I think it's a very valid question not to flip it on the learner saying, oh, well, teach me what you know, or this is part of your mock oral exam, but rather like, what have you seen has worked in the past? Oh, you're on your neuro rotation and it's month 2. It's been 3 months since I've done this, you know, beach chair position. What are your thoughts? And having that as an honest conversation is great.
One thing that I've found is that patients really want you to be confident in whatever you do. But you also have to balance that with the humility of knowing that you don't know everything and that you might not be right all the time. What do you think the best way is to balance the confidence and the humility?
I believe that the answer when a patient asks me about these things is to promise them or to impart in them that I will do everything I can to take care of you the way you deserve, the way the dynamic situation calls for. That's not to say I may not know an answer too long the way, or it might be a real-time dynamic decision. But I can clearly say when I wake up, you know, I'm prepared and I'm confident that I will do my best to take care of you the way you deserve. Some of those other things you can figure out along the way. You can look up, you can speak to expert colleagues who've done this, you know, longer, whom are smarter than me. But I have no problem telling a patient I'm confident in being prepared to take care of you the way I'd take care of any family member. Does that make sense? Separating the intent from the actual individual minutia of the medical decision-making.
That is actually something that I like to share with patients a lot as a way to build rapport, but it's also part of my actual underlying philosophy, which is helpful. I say, well, I'm telling you this information, or I'm presenting you with this plan, but this is the exact same thing that I would do for my family member, because I treat my patients as if I were treating my family member. That's just my underlying ethos about treating patients generally. And so I find that that can sometimes help patients buy into your plan. Like, I really am doing the best thing I can think of for you, and this is the best thing that we can do. I'm sorry, we do have to start that arterial line while you're awake. I know that's not going to be fun or comfortable for you, but I would also be doing this if it was my family member in the same situation.
100%. And I think two things kind of came into my mind as you were sharing this. And one is, this is not a substitution for training, preparation, reading, and doing all the things we need to do in order to deliver the best evidence-based care to that patient in that situation. But it's layering it, saying, I can't possibly know the 1,000 permutations of what may happen, but I have the training to fall back on how to assess and intervene appropriately.
So let's say that you could go back in time and talk to a previous version of yourself, give him advice when you're struggling with feeling like a fraud or that you don't belong. What would you tell the past version of yourself, what would you say to make him feel better?
It's a great question. I wish I could. I would say the stress about not having what it takes is inappropriately placed, meaning you work hard, you read, you prepare, trust in that process, trust in yourself, and reach out because everyone else is, you know, having some permeation of these feelings along the way, and reaching out for assistance, for help, for knowledge, for support is never a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength to know what you need and how to get it and whom to get it from.
How do you think that your perspective on imposter syndrome has changed over time?
I think that over time, my perspective has changed to this is not a me problem, but this is a problem common to folks in the medical field, to medical trainees. And part of my job is to support those around me who may have challenges, who may have intermittent periods where they feel like they don't belong, or despite evidence of high performance and well thought out plans and preparations, struggle.
Lastly, I want to go over what you feel like your style points are, whether or not it has to do with imposter syndrome specifically. What style points or points of personal preference have brought you success both in and out of the OR?
Good question. I'll tie this one into imposter syndrome, and I think more about vulnerability is over time, especially like over the past, 10 years, we've spent so much time on the focus of others in medicine. And for many of us, that was still formative years of your life from a mental and emotional development position. I feel like it's important for everyone, and this is a sojourn that I'm on myself, is to become reacclimated with yourself. You know, what makes me? What are my important values that I hold near and dear, that I'm willing to, my hill to die on, right? And, if you haven't had that insight and that self-reflection over the past years because you've been busy reading, Bearish and critical care medicine and everything else, that in order to provide the care and the calling that we all feel, or else we wouldn't be here, sometimes we forget that, we're people behind that. It's critical to focus on that. And I think that's, whether it's 5 minutes here or there, long weekends, in self-reflection, self-exploration, getting into a meditation practice, however that works for you, time will turn, whether or not you're ready for it, and don't miss out on the opportunity to know yourself. And I think that ties in. And it's probably one of the parts about imposter syndrome is just being vulnerable and being self-aware. And then you realize the feelings I have maybe aren't truly imposter syndrome. It's just pressure, right? And expectation. But, we're all people at the end of the day, and humanism is a real thing. And we owe it to ourselves to not only know ourselves, but to connect and support and love one another. But if you don't know yourself, it's really hard to do that for someone else.
Well, personally, I've had a really nice time connecting with you. Thank you so much for joining us, Ben.
Oh, I feel honored. Thanks for being here.
That's it for this month's episode of Style Points. Anecdotally, I've heard that the immediate and permanent cure for imposter syndrome is leaving a 5-star rating or review for this podcast. It can also help other people find the show. Genuinely, though, I appreciate everyone who listens. I also want to share that with the last episode, this podcast has been downloaded over 10,000 times in total over the last couple of years. Not really sure what that means, but at least my mom thinks that that's pretty neat. Lastly, take a deep breath. Open your eyes. We are all done.